So we'll start out. Welcome, everybody. We start out, as usual, with introductions. I'm Steve Bacon with Clark Regional Wastewater District.
Greg Schaefer, Clark County Development Engineering.
Christy Malman, Land Use Review.
Jamie Housley, Jordan Ramos.
Eric Alimo, SJ Engineering.
Andrew Gunther, PLS Engineering.
EIA, Clark County.
Brent Davis, Community Development, Wetland Habitat Review.
Mitch Edwards, Community Development Director.
Dean Bennett, Clean Water Division Manager.
Tyler, Public Works.
John Meyer, ATS.
Houston Amo, Well Construction.
Steve Madsen, Public Construction.
Cornell, Rachi Corporate.
Couple reminders, the meetings are recorded and posted on the website. Also, if you've got a cell phone, get it on vibrate or silent or something else that won't wake everybody up. Skip over to review of the upcoming events.
Upcoming events, back page of your agenda there, you'll see this general announcement. The County Council typically meets in their work sessions every Wednesday. It can begin as early as 9 a.m. We invite you to check the grid for specific topics and presentations. Likewise, council hearing every Tuesday with the exception first Tuesday of the month. Every Tuesday at 10 a.m. with the exception of the month. First of the month, evening meeting at 6 p.m. Specific council work sessions, as you see there, 78th Street Heritage Farm, August 8th, 9 a.m. Manufactured Housing Code update. Of course, we had Lori here with us recently on that. August 8th, 10:30 a.m. Historic Preservation Code update, August 15th, 9:30 a.m. Six-year Stormwater Capital Plan, August 22nd, 10:30. And finally, Heritage Farm Master Plan update, August 29th, 10:30 a.m. So a busy August there for the council. Planning Commission work sessions and hearings. Staff report, notice of DNS of manufactured housing, notice of DNS of draft code changes, and Northeast 99th Street extension. Staff reported notice of DNS August 2nd, so this evening, 5:30 p.m. Yakult Mining, staff report, and exhibit numbers 1 through 7, notice of DNS, location zoning, and comp plan maps, updated traffic study, and surface mining. We're in this evening, August 2nd, 6:30 p.m. And finally, staff report, colored maps, notice of DNS annual review app, legal lot, and traffic analysis, manufactured housing. Staff report, notice of DNS, draft code changes, and public comments received to date, Northeast 99th Street extension. Staff report, notice of DNS, August 16th, 6:30 p.m. Sorry, a little bit of a mouthful there.
Member announcements.
So member announcements, an update on our current vacancy. We posted a notice on that for the full month of July, so that closed right at the end of the month of July. So actually technically closed on August 1st, just this Wednesday. So I will continue to work with our county manager, and also we did get two applicants to get that filled. Hopefully we'll have that filled by our next meeting. And we now have a forum.
Review of the minutes.
Yes, Mr. Comments? Chair. Since Mr. Wallum is here now, I have reviewed the minutes and I move approval.
Second.
I've got a motion and a second to approve the minutes from last month's meeting. Any discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Okay. So. Ooh, almost back on time. Brent.
Just real quick on the member announcements. I don't know if
The next meeting, the September 6th meeting, that is also the same night as the Parade of Homes VIP night. I think a lot of people that are on this board will be going to that, and it's out in Camas. And it kind of starts right around 4:35, somewhere in there. So I don't know if there's any possibility to start the meeting a little earlier, like say 2, so we can get out, or have a lighter agenda, so we can maybe just kind of plan on being done by 4 o'clock next month. Just a general comment.
I think we've got 3 agenda items right now, and I think we can work with those to try to cap it at 4 o'clock.
Try to do it at 4. So. Okay, that works. That's it. Thanks.
All right. So I'm here today to brief the DEEB on a couple of things on the wetland and habitat front that are coming up soon. The first item is the Terrace Oregon White Oak Woodland Mitigation Bank. This is an effort we've been working on for a little over 2 years with a bank sponsor to develop the ability to create and purchase credits for Oregon White Oak Woodland impacts under our habitat ordinance. So we convened an advisory team with the DNR and the Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife and worked through a process very similar to the wetland mitigation banking process in terms of developing a plan, figuring out service area, figuring out what kind of credits could be assigned to the effort. And we are getting close to the finish line. So Cornell Rocky is here today. If you have any questions from the sponsor's angle. But we actually have several projects in the last 7 or 8 months that have proposed to use these bank credits as their primary mitigation. We've given them a grace period, understanding that it's, you know, we weren't quite through the approval process with the bank yet. The reason I'm briefing you today is because we are close to having a final instrument that we'll be taking to the county manager for signature. The bank instrument is essentially a contract between the sponsor and the county on how the bank is going to operate and be administrated. One thing that's a little bit unique about this bank is it's actually in the city of Vancouver's jurisdiction, so they will be issuing or have issued, they've issued some permits, they'll be issuing any additional permits required for construction in terms of CAO permit, any grading permits and that sort of thing. So the county's role is really to administer the operation of the bank and the transfer of the credits and make sure the performance standards for credit release are being met, much like the Corn Ecology do for a wetland mitigation bank. In the next month or so, Mitch will be briefing counselors on where we're at with this, and then also briefing the county manager, and we're in the process right now of getting final legal review and agreement on the actual instrument itself. So we're hoping within 6 weeks or so that we actually can have this certified and have credits available. So let's, if there's any questions.
So is it, it's south of Todd's Auto Body there?
I'm sorry?
I'm just trying to get the location of it.
So do you know where the Terrace Wetland Mitigation Bank is?
Yeah.
It's on Upper Burnbridge Creek,
yeah.
Where it used to be the Ajo Mint Farm.
Yeah.
So this is a triangular piece of property associated with that that is upland. A portion of it is actually part of the buffer for the mitigation bank. The mitigation bank review team agreed to allow the overlap of the oak bank with the buffer for the wetland bank. So it's basically the dead end of 152nd south of Fort Point.
It's south of Todd, southwest of Todd's Auto Body.
Yeah. And so the service area then is?
It's basically almost all Clark County, elevation below 550 feet, primarily because we don't see a lot of oak
above that elevation, and we've also excluded the Columbia River Gorge National Scenic Area because that has some of its own habitat regulations, and those oak woodlands have actually are recognized, you know, outside of the county's land use regulations. So,
cool.
Great. All right.
How's that going to work then? Is there going to be a fee per oak removed, or?
So from the county side, you're going to go through the regular permitting process, and we're going to determine how much mitigation we would normally require if you were doing project-specific mitigation. And then the bank instrument will specify how to convert that to a number of credits, and then the bank sponsor establishes the rate per credit, any transaction fees, and that sort of thing.
And I'm assuming you still have to go through the avoid, minimize before you can get to that
correct
level.
Yeah. So we'll still be consulting with Fish and Wildlife on individual impacts and looking for you know, preservation opportunities on site.
I would like to note this is probably the first such bank in the country. It's kind of a unique opportunity for Clark County and the city of Vancouver. So it's got to compliment Brent on the work that he's done on this. It's a great opportunity for us to be kind of leadership in environmental design. And absolutely a great thing to be doing.
Are you looking for anything from us as far as for support or?
Squirrels.
I think just a general, you know, this is not a council action, but we do want to make sure the council is aware of it and that they're aligned with the county manager moving forward. So I think all we really need to be able to do in our conversation with council is to say that we've presented it here, that, you know, we haven't, that there's a general level of support, but we don't really need a specific recommendation.
Yeah, I think it's a great, I mean, to help projects to move forward that were in, create an area that's going to have more, let's say, improved impact as far as in retaining that land and improving what it is, and then in these projects where it's unavoidable, maybe it's a smaller impact, be able to find solutions. I think that's great. I appreciate the fact that county is like pursuing that.
Yeah, I'd second that. I mean, sometimes you just can't avoid impacts on sites, so to have a good, viable alternative.
Yep.
Yeah, looking forward to it. So.
All right.
So should we have any quick motion in support or?
Yeah, do you need a motion from us? Or is it more information? Yeah.
If you would like to do that, I think that would help Mitch with this conversation with the council.
Yeah, probably can't hurt.
Yeah. So I move to recommend that we support the bank creation.
Yes.
Second.
Yes.
Any other discussion? All in favor?
Aye. I have a question though, Brent. What's the biological term for, like, when there's like a lot of nuts for the squirrels to eat? for some reason it popped in my head and I can't remember it, and it's better like when there you have oaks and clumps like that rather than isolation.
Well, I mean, I think that's, you know, I'm more of a generalist.
There's a term for it.
I think it's abundance.
Yeah, I mean, there's terms like abundance, and there's, you know, fragmentation of habitat.
Okay,
and
I'll try to remember it.
There's
a specific term for it. There's a specific term for it.
Yeah.
So the next item I wanted to brief you on is just actually 2 or 3 weeks ago, the Department of Ecology released new guidelines for their best available science documentation for wetland buffers. So, you know, this is basically the best available science that informs our wetland protection ordinance. And I guess the big takeaway from what they're proposing is right now on our wetland rating form, we use a habitat score of 4 points, which is very low as the what's considered low habitat function. And when you have 5 points or more, your buffers start to get bigger based on the need to protect wildlife habitat function in the wetlands. And Ecology, based on feedback statewide, has reevaluated that, and they've adjusted that threshold to 5 points. We're seeing a lot of wetlands that are rating with 5 points because of the way the rating form was restructured in 2015. So we've been having to apply larger buffers to quite a few projects, particularly in the rural area. Once you're outside the UGA, or even if you're at the edge of the UGA, you're likely to almost always score 5 points because of the way the rating form works, even if it's a completely degraded habitat situation. So overall, we see that as a benefit. And we're considering moving forward with an immediate code amendment to basically revise the buffer tables in the wetland ordinance in line with these new guidelines. There's a little bit of a downside because they kind of changed the way the buffers ramp from when you get above 5 points. And there could be some, there will be some circumstances if we adopt this now where when you are scoring, say, 6 points or 8 points, that the buffers would be larger than they would be today. I've sent out the information on these new guidelines with an inquiry to a number of the wetland and ecological consultants that we deal with to get some feedback on their opinions. So far, I've gotten pretty positive response in terms of potentially moving forward with this. The opinions that I'm getting generally are that the benefit of setting the threshold at 5 points instead of 4 points is pretty substantial, and the risk for the higher habitat scores is a lot less because they occur less frequently. So I've reserved a spot in the biannual code amendments that Jan is going to be bringing to you next month. The only challenge is because it is critical areas ordinance, and because we know Ecology doesn't like some of our other buffer provisions, and we have to go through the 60-day review, there's a potential that they could push back in such a way that would cause us to have to pull it from biannual process and wait for our 2024 update. So, anyway, I thought it'd be good to brief Deeb on the fact that these new guidelines are out there, and you know, that we're looking at them. And if any luck, hopefully we'll have some relief in with the biannual code process. So, any questions about that?
It'd be nice, I think, to see some examples of what those differences are and how it actually, like, sort of practical, because the numbers don't mean a lot just looking at them. So, in the future, like, when you're bringing it to council,
yeah, I could probably
some examples that might help you
bring some specific projects,
yeah,
that we've already reviewed.
Yeah, maybe that'd be great. The scoring, yeah, form. That
kind, I mean, the other big piece of it is we have a threshold related to what flexibility we have with stormwater facilities in the buffers based on that habitat score as,
yeah,
well. So getting that extra point,
right,
could simplify some permitting for some of the stormwater facilities.
Right.
That'd be cool.
And I actually have some great examples for that.
Good.
Great. Okay, I got a question. Is the new rules of DOE currently in effect right now? So the more stringent.
Well, they're not really rules. They're guidelines.
Rating guidelines.
Yeah.
So the more stringent buffer requirements are currently in the rules.
In our code, it's what we've adopted based on their previous guidance. We actually updated our buffer tables in 2016 after the new rating system went into effect, because we had to change the score thresholds from the old rating system to the new rating system. So if we don't get to do a code amendment, we're going to be living with the buffers that we currently have until we do a full CAO update, which we're scheduled for 2024 by statute, and we're probably going to try to do a little bit earlier so it's done in advance of the comprehensive plan update.
Okay, yeah, thank you.
Question, I guess depending on how that, what transpires with that, it seems like that in regards with the comp plan, they'll need to take in context that if there's a change to the negative or positive. But this may be a silly question. In looking at critical areas through GIS, has there been an update of recent on mapping for wetland areas? It just seems like it's substantially more extensive than what I've had seen in past years as far as what's showing as wetland area. Is there a mapping update?
Not to my knowledge.
Okay. Just the areas maybe that
I mean,
are
what
left.
It does change, and the reason it changes is because as we go through reviews and we make determinations, we update a layer in GIS that essentially masks what's in the inventory, which is, you know, not really accurate at the site scale. But that only affects sites that we've actually done reviews on, and we've got delineations, or we've determined building envelopes. That's something that I can look into, because generally we aren't using maps online at the staff level. We're in our ArcGIS, and so we're looking at the raw layers. So if something's changed in the way GIS puts those together and publishes them, that could potentially impact what we're seeing.
Well, and then also when I'm, you know, you're looking at it comp plan related, or you're looking at potential sites for projects or different things, it seems a lot more substantial than it has been in the past, but maybe I'm just looking at an area that it's been that way for a while and I just didn't realize it. So, but I've looked at a decent amount of areas and it just seems a little more extensive.
So we did our inventory in 2005, and that's...
It's a while, yeah. So,
been a while, but there are areas in the county that were not particularly active for any kind of development
and
at
been
that time that are
there.
Now much more active,
yeah.
And there are some large areas of map slope wetlands, I mean, like, square miles,
yeah,
because of changes that DOE wanted in the model back in 2004. And we know those are not terribly accurate. And it's actually, unfortunately, carried forward in the shoreline mapping. A lot of those areas are mapped, but we find when we get to those sites, we're not finding wetlands, or they're much smaller than what's shown on the map.
Yeah, that's what I've been understanding from talking to people like Eric, so.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
All right.
You need action on that?
No. Your opportunity will be when Jan brings it forward. Yeah.
Thank you.
Mitch, you're up next.
Yeah, so I'm new to this project, but I did spend some time with Susan Ellinger yesterday talking about the project delivery details group and the work that they did in advance of the CityGate implementation, which was kind of the motor that generated that work. I reviewed a lot of the work that was done under that project, and there's a lot of valuable stuff that we can carry forward through the CityGate implementation and the functional oversight team work. So when we get to the point at our third meeting where we're looking at the analysis of the strategic recommendations versus the work that the functional oversight team is doing, we're going to pull this work in as well and make sure that the recommendations that came from this group are also being addressed. Again, there's a lot of valuable information contained in that work. I think there was some good guidance given by that, and it's especially as it resulted in the CityGate study, which was very valuable in giving us a hard look at ourselves. So there's really not much to say there beyond we're going to be seeing that work again. I understand that the committee has not met in quite a while. There may be need to bring that group back together for just kind of at least a follow-up to ensure that that the value-added work that was prescribed by the group is actually being addressed and done. Just kind of, you know, close the loop and make sure that we have an opportunity to review all the work that we've done together as a collective to make sure we're doing the right thing and continue on to see if there's any metrics we can pull out of that as well. All right. That was quick.
Great. Fantastic.
I think our folks are here, yes. So maybe we'll skip
that and go to the...
Sounds good.
Number six, so that maybe we can just carry on with the conversation, too.
Okay. Jamie's not... I think he's
yeah, he did jump on a quick call.
Yeah, well, I guess we can kind of get started. One of the things that came out of the oversight committee that's been brought up, and as part of our deep plan as well, is looking at the SFR stormwater reviews and trying to simplify that review process. And one thing from just kind of digging around, I know a few years ago there was an optional developer certification where they can just use a PE stamp. It was never really popular with, I don't think, staff or even the engineering community. We actually, when I dug through my notes, there was a few recommendations, a few cautions that we threw into it, how the review process is pretty valuable, and it is it's a necessary set of checks and balances. So for a subdivision or a larger project, you definitely need those checks and balances. And you know, I said it before, engineering is not black and white. It's navigating shades of gray. That's why you're registered as an engineer and not a tradesman, or, you know, where it's the code is the code, like maybe a plumber or an electrician, where this is the way it needs to be. Engineering is a little more shades of gray, and you're balancing a lot of competing interests. So a lot of the review process isn't necessarily just straight code. It's where you can't meet code and how to balance those competing interests and shades of gray. So you need that process. Now, for an SFR, however, it's a very low risk. So the amount of review may reflect the amount of risk that the county has. And when you look at previously, they were exempt. Rural areas were exempt from stormwater review. Nothing was put in. So what we found now is we've almost over-regulated it, and I gotta say, going through an SFR is almost like going through a subdivision. You're going through some of the same reviews. You're going through sometimes three reviews. It's getting nitpicked, and the ironic thing is most of the time, you end up in the same place that you started. And a lot of the review is not based on even code, it's that information changed along the way. So the builder came in with a new, you know, they didn't have the critical areas figured out, and then they did, and things had to be shifted around. So we talked about trying to find a way to allow some kind of a certification to basically eliminate or really reduce the amount of review on SFRs. Not necessarily taking this PE certification and doing it in other areas, but maybe for set things that are a little more cookie cutter. I mean, spending three reviews to design roof downspouts, splash blocks, seems a little excessive. So, and it wastes these resources. They could use those same resources and catch up on their workload elsewhere. So a few ideas that I kind of just wanted to kind of bring forward was how we could kind of certify someone without making it unfair. So you can't like pick and choose, but it might be based on a number of projects that have been submitted and successfully approved. Maybe once they go through 10 to 15 projects or more, then they get on a list of, okay, you know what you're doing, you've gone through the process enough. Another possible idea is self-review through a checklist. So a lot of times you turn a set of plans and you're just turning the plans in. However, you guys have a checklist that you use for review. So what maybe could be done is if you're going to do that, you include that checklist and you actually fill it out as the reviewer, as the designing engineer, that yes, I've checked this. Things that you guys see a lot, like has there been a critical area study? Are wetlands listed? Does it meet the spacing criteria? And then you can kind of write in there what they've done. So it kind of forces the designer not just to do the plan, but to also answer critical questions and turn that in and sign that checklist as well that they looked at. So it does get a review. And in our office, we talked about maybe having someone else in our office besides the person who prepared it go through the list. So once you get it, it's actually kind of been peer-reviewed in-house based on that checklist. So Another kind of idea.
Yeah, so this really generated a robust discussion at the functional oversight team meeting because it hit home on a number of really important points. And Jane, Eric talked about the gray areas where the PE is sitting there looking at a site trying to make a determination. The gray areas are being navigated right now by some of these the third party reviewers as the strictest application of the code as applicable, and having to undo that is really arduous for all of us. And so if we're thinking about the quality of the application up front, and we have been provided by a PE a robust checklist that addresses all the points necessary for the wetland, for the stormwater, and it's obvious that they're competent and they're good at what they've done and it meets our precursory review, why can't we move that forward and eliminate that back and forth that occurs as a result of that? With the proposed revisions to our stormwater program and moving it all into wetland and habitat, we're going to consolidate that work with experts that have there's a higher probability of success in that work unit, and there's less back and forth between competing interests and reviews along the way. So I think we're really driving that issue home as one of the linchpins of what a successful permitting process looks like and what a time-constrained permitting process looks like as a barometer. Once we get this dialed in, it speaks to a lot of the other issues that we've encountered along our other permitting processes. This is an exciting time for me. It's an exciting time, I think, for the group of people that are working in this effort, because there's a lot of potential, a lot of possibility. This is just one of those areas where there's been so much robust feedback and interest from the community within which we work, and it talks about that mutual trust that we need to build, that our customers depend on us to have as professionals and regulators.
And as I understood, the goal is to try and have those changes implemented, and that would be February of 19. Is that
What was the schedule from the oversight committee? Because I know it was one that got bumped up in that.
Yeah, we're trying to dovetail it nicely with the go live for phase three. Okay. With LMS, so that they're not competing against each other for space.
Okay. So a few other just ideas that came out of kind of me talking to some of the guys in our office who do it, besides kind of that review checklist where you kind of do your own review, is having additional notes on the plans that aren't there now, especially if it's not going to be reviewed in-house. What we're going to have is something about if something varies in the field, to contact the designing engineer and giving the designer engineer kind of that flexibility to make like field calls. So basically the field calls are the wetlands, something's a little different, there's the ground changed from the initial topography to what they did when they graded the site, and all of a sudden what used to be the flow away now flows back, and those things need to be adjusted out in the field. And really the county review, it shouldn't have to go back through review again. What could happen is the designer can work it out with the contractor out in the field. There's kind of set rules about it has to be downslope, it has to have certain setbacks, and you kind of list those on the plans. And you just kind of give this note to the builder to say, if anything varies out in the field, you contact the designing engineer and you work it out. If it's a major change, say you're going from dispersion to infiltration, maybe the county needs to be notified at that point, but if it's moving something around that meets the setbacks, let's not waste your guys' time. You guys have better things to do. Sure. And you can push that off on the private sector. And ultimately, they're the ones that have to deal with it because it's on their home site. So you're not really necessarily protecting the general public. It's that homeowner and that builder. So they need to get it right. So let's see, any other things on there? The third-party reviewer, there was some challenges with the third-party reviewer. Again, we're navigating, I think, Mitch mentioned it. They're navigating shades of gray, and they don't have authority to vary from the code. So when you try to apply this code that's intended for much larger projects and you're applying it on a very small basis, sometimes it doesn't even work. And you have to kind of make these engineering judgment calls. And they're not able to do that. And because of that, it goes through several reviews. They finally get there, and we end up right where we started. So. And again, the final point was low risk, review correlates. So I'm not sure kind of where this group goes from there, but those are kind of the initial outlines that I wanted to kind of bring forward on how that program could work. Yeah.
So we, I mean, as a group, the functional oversight team voted to move this forward as a as an actionable item. So this is one of our goals, is to get there.
Okay.
That to me too seems like the dovetail that would occur between the DEEB effort and it kind of wraps into the functional oversight team. So
absolutely,
it seems like those come together right there. So
yeah, I think they're mutually complementary.
No. Sir, let me ask one, because, and I know this is back to the 2011 program, and it was much larger and everything else with the overall developer certification. And I think one of the things that really got to be a bit of a challenge there was when we got into terms of liability and insurance and all that. So I don't know if we think that we're also going to have to get, you know, take a look at those areas or not, or kind of how that comes into play with it. So.
Again, I think it's just these projects are such low risk that the review can correlate to the risk. I mean, I'm not suggesting. I never really was for the certification for all projects. I guess spoke against it, but in certain circumstances, like these SFRs, or I think retaining walls was another thing that kind of got brought in as well. If they're certified to do that, it's kind of it doesn't really take a lot of review. You just need to make sure you have the right information on that. So I know we have Columbia West do quite a few of those. It's very boilerplate. So I think it goes through a lot of review, it takes a lot of time, and it's probably not necessary, it doesn't change. So those were two areas that were kind of brought up that could have the review significantly reduced or eliminated in some situations. So.
Yeah, I wouldn't think the magnitude of it would be nearly as great as what it was being entertained, you know, back in the 2011
yep.
attempt with this. Maybe something that, as we formulate it, might be something we need to run by, you know, Bill Richardson or PA's office. Jamie's on the oversight team, of course. So
yes.
I mean, I think we've got good, you know, contact there. If we need to address something there about it. So.
Yeah, the risk assessment. From that perspective, if you're thinking about it, you know, informing an applicant as to what the requirement is, and if we have that interaction and we've given that critical information to the applicant and with a couple of stamps on the plans or whatever is necessary to do that, then the contractor, the developer, the people that are responsible for making that happen in accordance with the approvals and with the regulations have that freedom to do that. And if we go out there doing an inspection and find that they haven't done that, then there's corrective action we can take. Or if there's revisions that are necessary, we can bring it back through that. If it's a conversion from a from off-site to on-site retention and so forth, you know, major changes like that. But setting that barometer, yes, those are questions that we have to take through risk and a legal, get a legal opinion on it, because ultimately there is a level of responsibility for the county in our decision making, and we're ultimately accountable for that. I think it's important to recognize that, the PEs put a lot into their education and work and schooling and all that, and we should recognize that at a lot of levels. But this is an opportunity where they're coming to us saying, hey, look, you know, we are professionals, we're good at what we do, and when we can demonstrate that, we'd like, the flexibility. I think it's an extremely reasonable ask.
Sounds great.
So I guess the question is, what is DEEB's role and how can we help with that functional oversight committee? So we put it on our agenda to talk about it, but what is the process and where do we go from here?
Seems like now that we have you and Jamie also represented in the FOT, it seems like we've got a good closed loop there.
Yeah, I think the nexus is there.
Okay.
It just exists in that capacity. We wanted to come to you from the beginning with this entire process because you're DEEB's an important voice in all that we do and all that we regulate. But we can't, if we don't have your cooperation and support, we need to know that at the same level so we can take action to address it. I think the mutual confidence is what we're after. And so whenever DEEB can offer support and or introduce a resolution or whatever, providing support for that action, knowing where FOD is after the second meeting, where the functional oversight team meeting is, what our direction is, having DEEB's approval for that and acknowledgement of that work is going in a direction that is as planned would be fantastic.
Okay. So the functional oversight site committee, I would say short meetings. They're not actually short meetings, but they're covering a lot of information. So what would happen, but I think what I kind of saw would be a good approach is to maybe get a few people to kind of work out and kind of come up with a plan. Like kind of these bullet points that I did, that's what I was attempting to do, is kind of come up with, all right, this is a basic structure or an outline for how this plan could work, and then have some of that background work done before it goes to the next functional oversight committee. So we can then approve it there instead of talk about it more. It's like, we have a proposal, this is the groundwork's been done. What do you guys think of this? So
great.
And I'm going to offer up our, my time to help do that. And I've kind of already started it. So
that's actually, thank you for the offer. So I'm meeting with the internal team in the next couple of weeks. We're going to do two meetings and then reach out for that type of expert assistance.
Okay, sounds good.
Awesome.
I don't know if Jamie has anything
to do.
You came in
and out,
so
you can volunteer for me.
So I was going to say, does that make you the subcommittee chair?
Well, I say, no, it makes Jamie the subcommittee chair.
Yes,
because he's not here.
Yep.
But I'll assist for sure.
Okay.
Anything? I don't think we have to do anything with this yet. I think we've been talking about it. It's on our work plan, and it's just more of kind of an update and a plan to move forward. So once we have something, I think we'll bring it to a vote here for support, but we don't have anything to really vote on yet, so perfect.
All right. Yep. And then we're going to back it up a notch and turn it over to Bill. We were running a little ahead of schedule.
I've got Jay Chester and Kelsey Potter, our two co-chairs for the Parks Advisory Board.
Thank you for meeting us today.
Appreciate it.
You want to take the lead or do you want me to start
Sure. Yeah.
Yeah. Sure.
Sure. So Jay and I came to your meeting, I think 2 months ago, sounds about right, where there was a conversation about PIP credits and how there seems to be a desire for those. And so we're kind of here on an educational fact-finding mission from our board's perspective to hear what you guys kind of are looking for in PIP credits. Is your board all on board with wanting PIP, you know, advocating for PIP credits? Is this a couple people? Like, is there a consensus? And then kind of, if there is, what a PIP credit looks like for you, what you want to earn PIP credits for, and what other local jurisdictions are giving you in terms of PIP credits. So I just hammered 5 questions out at you. Pick your favorite and let me know.
I mean, I'd let the experts speak to what the process is like as far as in other jurisdictions, but I feel like it's a common sentiment of this board that's supportive of flexibility that can be provided in a private-public partnerships with parks that can be, we can see more better, maybe improved access, and also increase the amount of parks that are accessible for the public by using PIF credits and having that tool there for when those improvements are done, that there's a credit that's then given back to the builder. And maybe if there's neighboring parks, a developer or builder could construct that park and receive credits back in turn. They can build that park at a lesser cost because they're not underneath the same constraints as you, and there could be a win-win scenario where that park's available for that builder or developer to be an amenity that is attractive for their homes that they're building for that community, for that project. And so there's a motivation there, but it's just allowing, having that tool in place that facilitates for that to happen.
Okay.
And for other jurisdictions, I know that there are, I've seen that, but
yeah.
You can probably speak to that better than I can.
Yeah, this was part of a little bit more a robust discussion previously, and it started with the park impact fees and kind of going through the park plan and coming up with just some ideas to kind of, you know, probably some give and take in both places to try to improve the way the parks are done, to kind of not just lessen the PIF fee, the park impact fee, but also try to make it more inclusive of other areas that are not counted right now in the plan. So for that to work, it's part of a bigger overall piece. So one of the things that, I don't know, I took some notes, maybe I'll try to run through them really quickly, but allowing the parks, right now I think there's 3 to 5 acres are the only ones that are actually counted right now in the parks plan. But in reality, there's a lot of areas that provide recreation that probably should be counted. And if they are counted, then it's something where it opens it up where the private development private developer, when they're building their developments right off, you guys get in this land bidding war to try to find these pieces after private developers are fighting for the same land. And from looking through what you guys paid for land, you're way overpaying compared to what developers are. You're kind of getting the last ones on the market after things already developed, because you collect the fees, then you're trying to find them, and it's way more than market from looking at your information, I guess. So, but if you can work with developers to get that land as it goes, maybe even if it's in smaller pieces, maybe you allow for some smaller parks that provide immediate recreation, and that provides different types of opportunities, more than just a 3 to 5 acre park. But if those can, if that size can be shrunk, those can be incorporated into the plan, then you can get your land as it's developing, and developers might just give it to you, basically, as for the park credits. You don't have to go out and shop for it. You get it. Maybe they don't pay park impact fees, but they did your work for you. And they're also doing it probably, you know, under prevailing wage, not the same bidding process. So you get an asset for a lot better value. So we're looking to try to kind of partner to come up with a plan to help you guys deliver on your goals. But it takes a little change in the plan. So.
And when is this PROST plan open up again?
So the PROST plan was initiated in 2015. It opens every 6 years. So we'll start working on it in 2020 with the intent of finishing up in 2021, September. And so the one thing I'd like to see, and so we want to make sure that we have a collaborative approach, and how we're going to clearly define PIF credits, and I'm not sure if there's a better term than pocket parks, but you know, parks that are better developed by developers, if you will, to try to get that put into our PROS plan, so there's a provision there, into the capital facilities plan. It doesn't have to be specific, because we know that developments come along. We can't identify each and every one of them over the following 6 years, but have it broad scope enough to where we have a plan in place that if it meets certain criteria, that you know, we review it and approve it. And that's kind of what we want to go with this group here, is to actually have that discussion over a period of time, and we come up with a plan that seems to work for everybody.
What year did you say it opens up again?
2021 is when it has to be approved. So we'll start talking in 2020. And so, but it's realistically, we'd like to have this, you know, PIF credits identified in the plan, as well as taking a look at our park standards, you know, reducing sizes below 3 to 5 acres down to something that we can all agree upon. What is acceptable? You know, what will we accept? And then when it comes to PIF credits, what is creditable? You know, is a piece of property worth a full credit, you know, dollar for dollar, or is it worth a half a credit? And so there's probably some different criteria that we actually have to take a look at. And so that's kind of what we're thinking about. So I think our purpose here today was to see if we as a group, you know, the two boards, want to meet and actually discuss in the next, you know, over a series of meetings probably, the best approach going forward, how we're going to do this. So when the time comes up, we'll already have this kind of already vetted as well.
So I think from the group, we definitely want to be involved in the next process and work together on it. Another piece, the schedule is a little concerning, because 2021 is kind of far away.
It is.
And when the park impact fees were adopted by the board just recently, I think it was last year, they kind of made a plan. They said, you know what, some of them jumped significantly. Like, you know, sometimes, if I remember right, you know, 200-300% in some areas. So it was significant. It was kind of like, wow, what happened here? Why did they go up so much? We have a great park system now. You guys are doing a great job. Was that really justified? And the board was not like, what they wanted to do is say, you know, like, we'll adopt it now, we have to do it with our comp plan. But they committed to revisiting that and trying to find if there was some savings. And these are the kind of things that came out of this group, is like looking at smaller parks, having public-private partnership to kind of bring those down. Allowing PIF credits. So I don't know that with the board's direction that we got from them, 2021 soon enough. Do we need to start looking at least some interim things that address that park impact fee increase and how what we can do, what low-hanging fruit? I know we can't go through the whole plan. That's a huge process.
Right.
But is there some low-hanging fruit that we can use right now to basically, you know, help you guys earlier and also bring those park impact fees something a little more reasonable? Because we talked about it before. Well, everyone wants great parks, but we also have an affordable housing crisis. And if all these things get passed on to the consumer, so it's great if we have great parks, but it's not great if people can't afford to live in the homes that are served by those parks. And that's what we're dealing with right now. So we're trying to balance those things and do the best for both. So
the one thing, just real quickly, the one thing that we are working on right now, that we're actually going to be talking about this in the September DEED meeting, is we have a contract with the Conservation Techniques to take a look at introducing trails into the PIF plan as well. And so with that, we're also looking at consolidating PIF districts from the 7 that we've got down to 3. So it makes it a lot more easier to work in the long term, especially when it comes to connecting trails. So we're not crossing over 5 different districts. We're crossing over a maximum of 3. And so with that, we're going to have to actually open the plan to make a provision in there. So we could potentially talk about adding something to this plan or amending the plan prior to the 2020, 2021. So that's what we're talking about with the trails and all that. We're trying to get that on this year's docket. We may or may not be able to get that done. We're hoping that we can try to get it done at least next year. So if that is the case, that we have to open up this plan ahead of when it expires, then we can probably talk about this in the near future. And then when we do open it up and say early 19, we can probably make that provision. That makes sense.
Yeah, and just to go back to some of the points you were addressing, I'll say that our board definitely feels that, yes, we should be working together on these issues, and that you guys probably can build parks cheaper than we can. We totally know that and want to pursue that. Trust me, we want to pursue that. So just some of our concerns, though, and why we're a little hesitant to just be like, let's open this up and do whatever, is we have these pre-planned parks that we've already promised to citizens. And so if we give you PIF credits for these ones you're building in development, we're taking from the fund that's supposed to go to the park that we already promised neighbors in this area. So that's kind of where, you know, several of us are a little, we want to build these into the plan in the future, or have the provision for, if it's in this square area, like a plan we had maybe for this plot will shift to where a developer says, hey, we have this land, we want PIF credits for it, let's talk about that. So that's kind of one of our concerns on starting a little bit early, as we do have these pre-promised parks already, and to give here is to take from there.
So do you kind of have a service area for those planned parks? Do you have kind of a little circle around them? So maybe in those areas where park impact fees aren't available yet because it's going to be served by this park, and you basically have to pay towards it. But at the same time, making sure that the park impact fee, when that plan was put together, was it at this higher one that's, you know, 2 to 3 times higher than it used to be? Or, because then what happens is the new guy pays way more than the last one for the same park, and we're just trying to make it, you know, a little more, you know, share that burden.
Yeah, and I know they went up a lot, but we didn't get a park impact increase for 13 years. So I'm sure it seems astronomical and horrifying on your end, but it seemed astronomical and horrifying on our end to go 13 years without an increase. And we do have great parks, but we're seriously lacking on a nationwide average for what we should have. And so if you guys can help us get to that goal, we definitely want to talk about how we do that. We just don't want to shortchange people we've already promised parks to in certain areas.
Well, that was part of the discussion about, you know, why can't the pocket parks be considered in part of the inventory? Because the whole premise is we are really short on inventory compared to the national average, but we've got all these, and not all pocket parks are going to fit the mold. I mean, you would have to set up your standards based on amenities or something, so that for every mile of trail, you that counts so much. For every basketball court, it counts so much.
Yeah, that's what we envision too. Yeah.
Those types of things, but to completely ignore the existing private recreation opportunities seriously underestimates the inventory you have. So you can say, oh, we're really short, but in reality, you're not. I mean, you don't have people banging. I mean, you've got certain groups that want more parks in their area, and I get that. There are areas of town, especially the older areas of where the development happened longer ago, there aren't any parks there because it was developed out before any of this stuff really came up. But in the newer development standards and PUD standards and all the other things that we've got going on, there's a lot of small parks, walking trails. They're incorporating walking trails into their wetland areas. They're incorporating them into even their stormwater facilities. So there is a lot of missed opportunity, and to, I mean, just, I think that is part of the, you know, part of that overall discussion is, you know, are we actually underestimating the need because the private developments are building private parks for their developers or for their developments, you know, the people in those neighborhoods that have the play structures and the basketball courts and stuff like that, they don't need to go to the neighborhood park to find those. They've got them in their neighborhood.
But so, the neighborhood right across the street that doesn't have one,
right,
can't go to those private parks. Well,
but you're dealing with populations as much as areas, yeah, because you have to have more parks in an area because the population is greater. So you're, you know, if you don't exclude or if you don't consider these other opportunities that are taking the population away from your need, it's kind of like, you know, neighborhoods that have elementary schools, those playgrounds and ball fields and soccer fields and stuff around the elementary schools are always full of kids and parents and everything else. It's not just during school. That's where a lot of the neighborhood people go for their recreation. They don't go to the park because it might be further away. It might not have the same level of equipment, whatever. I've got kids. I know that they get very picky about their playground equipment. And no, I don't want to go to that park. I want to go over there because they have this cool whatever it is. So it's just, that's kind of my biggest. I guess, you know, point on the at least the PIF increases based on the need, because it sounded like there was this, you know, we're stuck on a 3 to 5 acre park size. We're not going to even look at any of these other things that are out there if they aren't you know, parks owned public parks. We're just not going to consider it as recreation opportunity for the citizenry, and that does the citizenry a disservice, because you're charging them for something they already have access to through that through that private park.
But we can't give you PIF credits for a private park.
Yeah. Right, but
it has to be open to the public.
But if you included them in the inventory, then that would lower the
correct
the overall need, which lowers the PIF, which is, I mean, that's
sure.
kind of
if
the,
open to the public.
But the PIF is calculated on what's there now to a degree,
right?
What's potential and what we're going to have to do. One aspect we need to also consider is we have to maintain those parks, the public parks.
Right.
We have to develop those parks, so. That's a balance, and all we're talking about is we've got to figure out a balance, and we're willing to come to the table and try to figure out that balance,
because yeah, and it's,
all those aspects there have to, we have to balance it all through.
Right, but the HOA, yeah. But what I'm, I guess all I'm getting at is it's a supply and demand thing.
Yeah.
In the end, if the HOA is supplying that amenity, then the public doesn't have to, and therefore you don't have to spend the money on that park. You don't have to spend the money to build more parks because the HOA is already built.
And our budget is set up right now where we don't spend money on those private
right,
parks
no,
because they're not considered in the program.
Exactly, but they're not. But by not considering them, you're saying you need more than what you actually need, and that's the.
True. So I think if we kind of create a standard of what that is, and we're saying our neighborhood parks are, with the land issue, are too big. So I mean, we're all kind of
yeah,
agreement. That these 5-acre neighborhood parks are probably a thing of the past. So I think what we need to kind of work on as a group is coming together on what a standard is for a park and what amenities you can provide, and that equals this much of a PIF credit or these many PIF credits. Again, it doesn't have to be size, but like, you know, it has to be a walking trail, a basketball court.
Yeah.
That these things all add up to create PIF credits.
The smaller it is, the more impact you'd want to have in that
sure.
area.
I mean, that's the direction everybody's going.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because right? people don't want to walk 6, 7, 8 blocks to go find a park necessarily.
Yeah.
Which increases your access yeah. ability to it. And to kind of go agree with what Steve said, not to repeat anything that he said, is I think on, I know for instance, on HOAs, if I can It's unfortunate to me when I see open spaces that, let's say, Clark County Legacy Lands has available, and then we could have trail systems that go through that area, mm-hmm. and then the HO, for instance, there was a site that we brought on that we could, you know, we could have had an opportunity to improve and increase the trails through a project, and you know we'd have to, but we didn't have park impact fee credits available, mm-hmm. so the timing of it didn't allow for that to take place. And the unfortunate part is projects take so long to go through the process before they come to fruition. When we're talking about something, let's say that happens a year from now, that would be applied to a project that's gonna see homes in, let's say, 2 to 3 years, best case. So when we say 6 years, we're really saying 8, you know, or 4 years, however far out it is. It's just we're pushing that window out that far, and the concern is there is a substantial amount of developments taking place today. There's a substantial amount of projects going through planning today. And to open up that toolbox, as I would see it, that can help on the, it's not just flexibility on getting parks constructed at lesser cost, but it's also on the maintenance side. And I do think that HOAs can really help in that regard. I think there's yet to be concern, if I'm fair, on the other side of it, is how reliable is an HOA gonna be with funding? So there's something to be said for that, but I think you're going to see more partnership opportunities and really take the strain off, as Steve is addressing, and have more parks available at lesser cost and actually, in a way, get more funding for these parks through the private-public partnership. And we have the 179th Street corridor that's going to open up, and there's some great trail connectivity that could happen there.
Yeah.
But if that doesn't come available in a shorter time frame, unfortunately, we're going to have gaps, and it's going to make it difficult. So, 119th Street was a great corridor that we could have done that with potentially, and having some connectivity of trails or things of that nature. But and that's how, for I know at least for me, when I see it is I just would love to see what I see in Ridgefield and Camas as far as there is some trail connectivity and. In our areas that tend to come up with urban holding releases, as it happens, that we can take advantage of that and be prepared for it and not have it be, unfortunately, it's going to be the next property that comes up.
And we're definitely trying to fast track that component, the trail PIF credit component.
That's a big priority piece,
to move that quickly through the pipeline.
So I think there's a huge misconception here. PIF credits are not really required, okay? I could go into a neighborhood, say I have a 40-acre parcel. I decide I'm going to put a 5-acre park in there. I'm going to develop it to public standard and put it in there. Okay, and then what happens if I try to turn it over to you? I say, you can have this park for free. It's absolutely yours. I just don't want to pay PIF impacts in my development. What do?
If I already have a pre-promised park a couple miles away that we already have the land and we are collecting funds for, I don't want to pay to maintain your land and my park.
My HOA is going to maintain it. That's the deal, okay? Say my HOA is going to maintain 5 acres. It's going to serve this area, 5 acres. 40 acres is 250 houses approximately, okay?
I don't want to get in a minute discussion about specific things, but I'm just saying,
you're taking
PIF fees away from a pre-promised park right down the street,
and
for us to give you PIF credits for.
A PIF is a form of impact fee by definition is a form of mitigation. So I pay the PIF to mitigate for the houses I'm building, not the houses down the road. And if I'm supplying a park in the neighborhood,
I think we have
there
a
is no
opinion on that.
So, and I don't think we're going to come to an answer.
Oh, that's fine. And I can tell you, we develop across the state of Washington, okay?
Right.
And I put parks across the state of Washington.
Okay.
Typically, what the Parks Department, the jurisdiction does, is they go 2 acres per thousand or 5 acres per thousand, which you guys have as a standard as well.
Okay.
And based off of that, that's how they determine what amount of park you have. So, say I do a 600 lot prelim and the amount of area if I was to donate land would be 20 acres. Say the park department says, our spec is we want a 5-acre park. Okay, here's a 5-acre park. then off of that prelim, they'll put you what your PIF fee is for the rest of the neighborhood, and they can either go develop it or choose to develop it, and that's how the PIF is regulated. This conception of I can't give you or not charge you a PIF for your neighborhood, I think is absolutely wrong.
But what if we just had developers constantly trying to give us land to not pay for PIF credits that we don't want, and then we have no parks because we don't have any money to build actual parks?
They have to be finished.
They have to be finished or a portion of PIF goes to finishing up to the spec you want. Because right now, I think land is the hardest thing you can get, okay? And if you can put land in a neighborhood, you know, you have want to be half a mile, okay? So you, right? Neighborhood park's half a mile. You just said 2 miles down the road. Well, I'm offering to put it in there. You know, it's...
Because I think
so,
we're
not going to solve anything here.
We are.
So I think what we need to do is agree as two groups that we need to come together and come up with a solution. They could probably address some of your concerns and everything else. And I understand you think we have a fundamental error in our thoughts. And I appreciate that, but we're not going to solve anything here. And you're not going to convince us.
No, I won't. But the way the process goes is at prelim, you would propose your park, and it goes to the Parks Department or the Parks Board for recommendation on it. And that's how it works in the other jurisdiction. So that's kind of the checks and balances, so you don't end up with 20 acres of wetlands. Because I know as a community and a developer, people will do that, and I don't want to see that. But if you can work hand in hand, that would be great. If not, right now you're probably opening yourself up for a little bit of a lawsuit because of the mitigation on the PIF. PIF is a form of mitigation, so if I put a park in that meets the standard of my neighborhood plus, it's kind of...
Well, I mean, if you think you need to go to a lawsuit, then that's fine. But what I'm saying is we just need to all agree that we need to come together as a group and have a conversation and continue these conversations. I mean, that's fine.
So basically, you know, with the RCW, it does have to be planned, you know. And so that is the one thing. And I think it's a great opportunity for us to have these discussions.
Yeah.
And then over between now and, you know, sometime in the future. But, you know, I think the idea was here is to introduce the fact that we want to discuss, you know, different possibilities. And we can do that as the two groups and get together and come up with a cohesive plan that everybody finds agreeable.
And I would urge you to look at the Tri-Cities in general, especially Pasco, where your community development director is from. Okay, Pasco has great parks, and they work great with the developers and the community to make everything work efficiently and at an affordable price. So,
okay.
Thank you very much for
the time. The future, for sure. Thank
you. So, I think there's some... I think the main challenge was, and why we were here, is because of the board. We're an advisory group to the board, and the board kind of directed us after the fees went up. I think there was a condition that when they go up, we need to look at why they went up that much, and is there anything we can do? Is there low-hanging fruit that we can do to address that sooner than later? And I understand you guys, you know, they've gone up, they haven't gone up in 15 years. 13 years. But at the same time, in those 13 years, what was the rate of inflation in those 13 years? And also, what was the wage inflation in those 13 years? Was it triple? Probably not. So when we're looking at the impact to housing and affordable housing, it is disproportional. So trying to find if there's like what Mr. Bacon was talking about, if the plan right now is based on funding for parks that aren't currently being counted, can we count those? Is that a way to mitigate for that immediately? Because that's something we can look at earlier. And if there's, I kind of fall maybe in between on some of the positions on the park impact fees, mm-hmm. I think you guys need to make sure it fits into your plan before you accept it as a credit. There has to be some give it to you. You don't want to be taking land that's useless or a liability to you. But there's a great opportunity for you guys, too.
To take great land.
To take good land.
Yes.
And to have your job done for you at a better price.
Absolutely.
They can bring their cost down.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And let's do
that. That is what we want to.
Let's
do
all in agreement.
I think we're all on the same page there.
Yeah.
And so I think that's our building block.
So what we want to do, though, I mean, I think this group here, we're really concerned about affordable housing. We're really concerned about that fee going up so quickly right now. So what can we do? Because it was, you know, we want to make sure that park
the developers and the development community, they all want great parks too. That's what that helps sell houses.
Yeah.
But it's got to be proportional and a reasonable price.
Uh-huh.
So if we can do something to immediately, and I would say like the low-hanging fruit is count land that we didn't, count smaller parks, count some of the dual-use facilities, things that, like schools that aren't in your plan right now to provide those opportunities, make sure they get counted so we're not overcharging and have more of a need than we actually think we need. So if we keep everything in the model, then we don't have to fund things that we don't need because we already have it and to meet the goals. And then, you know, coming up with a plan for credits for new developments, not in the areas where you already have a park planned and you're halfway done with it. That probably doesn't make sense for you guys, but just because we did it away like in the past doesn't mean we have to do it that way in the future.
No, so it's fine.
You have to start somewhere. So coming up with a plan to start doing that, I think makes a lot of sense. And if it can help reduce your park impact fee, let's do that now. I mean, I don't think we can wait till 2021. So how do we get there? What can we do to help you guys with that?
Well, we need to talk more. I think that's the bottom line. So we need to actually focus in on each of these different disciplines, if you will, and figure out how we can best come to agreement. Does that make sense?
Yeah. So what's the next meeting, or what's the next step? We can all sit here and agree we're going to do something. We get up and walk away. Do you want to wait till next meeting again?
Do you want to form a committee, or do you want to just come to our Parks Advisory Board meeting?
One or two people on each side get together.
I think that would probably be best.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah,
we have a couple of our kind of maybe biggest advocates, so to speak, or proponents of us all talking that aren't here.
Mike,
why don't we do this? Why don't you guys let us know two or three people you want to put on the committee. We'll let you know two or three people on ours, and then we'll get together and form a meeting and have an organizational meeting of the subcommittee.
I'd like the subcommittee. Again, us being involved at your entire meeting, that a lot of times is where something's formed, but it's not where the work's done. So at this point, I think we're where we want to get the work done, come with a real proposal. Come with a way to bring the park impact fees down to a reasonable amount and still provide the goals, meet the goals of your plan.
But we need to do that together. We can't do that one and the other and then
have to do it together.
The council decide who gets
to. We want to go in unified.
We agree wholeheartedly. So what we'll do then is, as I would say, next meeting, each one of our next meetings, we provide some people, three names on each side. We'll get and we'll drive that to a meeting. The subcommittee and have an organizational meeting.
And I'll lead that on the deep side too.
Okay.
I'll put out an email and solicit volunteers for that. So.
Okay.
And we'll do the same. We'll
do the same.
Yeah, we've got five of our Parks Advisory Board members are here. Parks Relations. Great.
Thank you for coming. I know you guys had to take time out of your day to come, so appreciate you coming here.
Appreciate it from the Parks Foundation, just the working together. I think we have more common ground than we know right now. And I think we all want to get to the same place, which is thriving parks, trails, and recreation opportunities in our community that do value added for each and every one of your homes. A good 10% of all the market value is a happy place for all of us. It improves our tax base and it leaves a good community for all of us. So I know we're all working together to get to the same place. It's so wonderful to have all of us agreeing to that. And from the foundation side, we're just excited for the opportunity for partnership. And that's how good things get done.
Yep.
Great.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks
for having us.
Thanks,
everyone.
Appreciate it.
Thank you, Sean.
Scary. We're still ahead.
Yeah, we're doing good.
We are. That's a big agenda.
Bojan's out here.
Yes. Yeah.
Thank you. See you later.
Yep. Have a good day, everybody.
Go for it.
Okay. Thanks for letting me step on last minute. So it's been a while since I've seen you guys. It's Gary Albrecht, Clark County Community Planning. So I am working on in our arterial atlas amendment. So in your packet, there's a map. You pull out the map. So instead of giving me a bunch of maps, you just have one map. So right now, in our current arterial atlas, we have a road connection on 99th Street that goes up through the neighborhood. So it goes through the yellow up to the red.
So we have, the county has dedicated right-of-way through this subdivision right here. And so we recently had a property owner realize that we have this road on the arterial atlas, and they didn't want it there. So it's like, wow, okay, that's great. So, you know, what do we do with our road here? So on our arterial atlas, it says it goes and connects to Northeast 72nd Street or Northeast 72nd Avenue. So we were communicating with Washington State Department of Transportation, the Utility Transportation Commission, and they indicated that the state has some policies that strongly discourage an at-grade crossing. So which means that we would either have to go above the railroad or below the railroad. So we had to hire a consultant, HDR, to come up with some options for us for this alignment. So that's this study here. Now, Public Works wants to see this connection to Northeast 72nd Avenue. They've done some work on 99th Street above the Lickner landfill. It's in design right now. And the construction for that segment is estimated at 2021. So they'd still like to see a connection go through. So Community Planning has done some 2035 RTC modeling, and it shows there's congestion relief off on Northeast 119th and Northeast 88th Street. So having this connection here is important for us. So the yellow line is the preferred alternative for for this change, or to have this change. It creates the least amount of impact to the neighborhood. So so crossing through here, it goes 2012, there was some Curtin Creek mitigation done by Public Works. So they planned to have the road go through this stretch. So if it goes through and connects to 99th Street, there's additional environmental impacts to this area. So this drainage basin right now is basically at max. So in order to do this is going to cost more down over here, and it would take out, I believe, 9 homes to connect this end to that end. Okay. So going up through the existing right-of-way, turning to miss the trucking business, coming down through a roundabout, which is designed for the map, kind of going down and connecting to Northeast 72nd Avenue, it creates the least impact, and it's the least expensive of all the alternatives. So this is what I'm going forward with to the Planning Commission at a work session this evening and a hearing on August 16th. This alternative J. So I've been out to the neighborhood. I had an open house April 6th in 2018, and magically, people that lives here, they like this one. People that lived here like this one. So
yeah,
and a lot of the complaints I heard were about, you know, why now? Why do we need this? Why do we, you know, I bought my home 20 years ago. I live in a nice neighborhood. I don't want this. And what about our wetland over here? I don't want that. It was a lot of NIMBY. And I totally hear that. But, you know, as far as the transportation system and thinking, so that's what we're going forward with. And I would like to know if you guys have an opinion and support our this alternative. We're calling it alternative J, alternative F. Alternative J is the blue line.
So which one do you want, the yellow line?
The yellow line.
Alternative F. And alternate, what's the, what? Where is it currently on the?
Well, the currently goes yellow section to the red. So I didn't talk much about the red line. So the red line, an overpass, would take a 23-foot tall overpass at an 8% grade starting right here. Hmm. So it would be super steep and cut back down, and you have big walls on either side of this. And then if you go under, it's going to be 17 foot deep going under. So you're still going to have walls on each side.
It's going to be expensive.
Yes, it takes you all the way.
Yes, it would be expensive.
It takes you out of the
railroad crossing is.
Isn't there an at-grade railroad crossing already on 78th Street?
Like 72nd Avenue.
It's a 72nd. Isn't there one on 78 somewhere, though? Or Patton?
On 78.
Near our office. 78, yes. But 72nd, there isn't.
Yeah, no, but on 78, there's an at-grade crossing already.
Yes.
And for a much more major road than at-grade.
It does, yes.
Yeah, at-grade.
And then it crosses on 118th Street again. It crosses over the surface.
But if it stays on the current alignment on Northeast 101st, that would be a new at-grade crossing.
A new one,
which,
besides what's already there.
Which the state's discouraging us to have.
I got a question. Is there any reason why you couldn't use the west leg of alternative J?
The west leg of alternative J and what?
The blue line.
The blue line
parallel. Roundabout and then go north.
And then go north? Well, so the problem with that is this intersection here, it's gonna queue too much with the railroad crossing. So that's a traffic problem right there. So that's why that's not likely to happen. So what Public Works wants to see is if the yellow line goes through, they want to stub this so it's no longer a road through. So they'll be able to access it from the inside and come down, but it'll be stubbed.
I'm assuming the yellow line, as it travels west, the reason why it goes so far south is to avoid wetlands. Is that why it's traveling so far south?
There's some wetlands, yes. Up on, yes. So in that first corner right up here, there's some wetlands back up in here.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And
sorry, but
sure.
This could be developed as a capital project, or do you mean developed as parcel development?
So yeah, I'm glad you raised that question. So there, none of this right now is on the current 20-year capital facility plan or the 6-year transportation improvement plan. There's no money to develop any of this road as it currently sits right now.
The problem I see with that is all those curves, none of those properties are going to develop.
Correct. Well, you know, yeah.
It's going to have to
be. You see that too often in your parallel atlas, and it's a big problem with a lot of properties that have curved arterials on. You can't access off of them, especially for residential.
Well, when you say can't, you can. You can access it. It's not how you want to, but you can access this stuff.
It's harder.
All right. It's harder, but you can. There's a difference between can and can't.
Well, if you have residential lots or residential zoning there, it makes it really difficult. I understand a lot of that's industrial.
So, yes, yeah, so this side basically right here is residential. This is industrial.
I think the stuff up north is residential. It's never going to develop. Put that on there.
This would be
easy. If it was a straight alignment, it would have a better chance.
A straight alignment where? I mean what?
Through residential.
Which one are you talking about? Which line?
The red.
Yeah, well, so. Yes, but there's a cost with that that's really expensive, and it's not good for pedestrian or walking traffic. So it doesn't provide a good alternative mode for transportation. So you're going to have an 8% grade going up from here to here to 23 feet and then back down.
I understand that, but I think it's either you got the expensive route or you got no route.
That's your choice. Staff has made a choice. This is the recommended alternative from our consultant that we've hired, so that's what we're proposing.
Okay.
And the hearing's on August 16th. You're welcome to attend that. And make
to change it from the blue line to the red line. And the yellow, the yellow line.
Red to yellow. That's the current.
That's the current line.
So the current one is this upper one, red to yellow.
Yes.
Yeah. Now you're changing it just to the bottom.
Just to the yellow.
Yes, just the bottom.
But there's no funding to actually build it. It's just going to change it to the arterial atlas. So whoever has those properties has to build it then.
Correct. And it may or may not get built. So we just recently dropped off a segment of the arterial atlas last 2016. Mm-hmm. It was supposed to go over to St. John's,
So the church was built there, so we just got rid of that segment because ultimately they wanted to connect all the way over to Highway 9, have an east-west connection there, but development has stopped it from happening. So again, this might happen in the future. It just wouldn't happen because the county doesn't buy right of way. But at least having a line on the map so we can show where we would like growth to go.
And you say that the state, for the rail crossing, they're pushing back against, they would prefer that you find an alternative that doesn't require, I understand that you're saying for an overpass over it now, but if you were to do a crossing at that railway location, there hasn't been a no that's been given, but basically they're pushing you to say not to.
They are. So there's a curve. You don't see it. So the railroad comes up here, comes down around, and curves, and comes down this way, and curves around.
Okay.
So there's a curve here.
So it's a little bit of a blind curve prior to the work.
Yeah. I mean, it's not like we have a lot of railroad traffic.
Right.
Yeah.
Honestly.
Right.
I wonder if we're making a problem out of something that's not. This was like the main Burlington Northern track. Yeah, we don't want an accurate crossing there. This gets used how many times a day or a week? It's not as high impact.
This section, you're counting them in times a week. You're not counting them in times a day.
Right. Yeah. Right. So when you're looking at already, we have an aggregate crossing on 72nd and down on 78th. It's a much busier road.
Correct.
So are we making a problem out of something? I know they don't like aggregate crossings, but this isn't also a typical railroad. So does the red one kind of still make sense if we don't do it and we do an exception to do an aggregate crossing?
That's what my sentiment is.
Yeah, is that even possible? Or is that off the table?
It definitely doesn't make sense with the over ramp. That's for sure. Just the cost associated would be ridiculous for
going over or under. Would be ridiculously expensive.
Well, so the staff is moving forward with a position that the state is not going to allow us to have an aggregate crossing at this intersection.
So that's an assumption, though. No? Do we know that's really the case?
So with communication with them, yes, that's the case. That they're discouraging us from having an accurate crossing. So we don't have money to build anything, so we can't get an official answer.
Right.
Gotcha.
So what we can't, but I mean, one of the property owners that lives right here realized this and doesn't want this road going through there. So they talked to the county council, and which put this on our docket list for community planning of changing this. So are we creating a problem? I kept explaining to this property owner there's no money to build this road, not now or in the future.
And it doesn't change for them that property owner.
Well, and that property owner has since sold her home and moved to downtown.
But it doesn't affect the development of the other property.
It does,
Yeah.
All the ones along the state corridor. Mm-hmm.
Carriage, just a suggestion, I mean, personal dog in this fight, but it seems like since the county has zoning, has the control of the zoning ordinance, at least the minimum they can do is if this is what they're going to put in, make sure that the adjacent zones are consistent so that the property owners can at least get the maximum advantage of the property based on whatever impacts this road are. In other words, if those two vacant parcels under the curve or residential, better utilized industry should make, or like that little triangle up on the top there of the curve, should make the property owners have to go through a rezoning application to utilize best use of their property. But that seems like needs to go with the road.
It's a great suggestion. Thank you.
If there's a few parcels on here that become almost useless with this, like the one just to the northeast of the little roundabout there, how it diagonally cuts across that property. That property, that's almost a taking there. Yeah, just the one, the kind of long, skinny one that kind of runs north and south. When that thing's going really diagonally, get an intersection to that roadway, that it makes the right-hand turn, you have no access to your property anymore. So your access to an arterial, I don't know what you're going to do with that property.
It's built a roundabout.
Nobody. It'll never get built.
Then why even do the arterial atlas changes if we don't think it's going to get built?
Well, the roundabout one.
Yeah. It's almost like when there's a development that's, I don't know. If there's a development that's proposing it and is developing in this area, that's when you really have to, that's when it triggers it. But
yeah,
there's a lot of properties impacted by that yellow line. and the diagonal part of this. Really,
there's about 18 properties impacted by the yellow line.
Yeah. Yep.
Yes, but and it would, and it's still the least expensive, and it would and has the least amount of impacts to the whole transportation system right here. Hmm.
Is there something you're looking? Is there anything you're looking for from us?
If you want me to share with the Planning Commission that you support this, you don't support it, you have concerns, because I'm just going to tell them this evening that you guys are aware of the project.
And
court. Yeah. Well, Jenny can come back in.
I might have to.
Yeah.
How are you working on this? Well, that doesn't affect the farm.
Now you could say you like it the way it is and you want to keep it the way it is instead of changing it. That could be a recommendation.
You know, it's one of those where personally I haven't been involved in the whole process and I feel like we don't know everything. Just my gut feeling on it is that yellow line affects a lot of properties, and if there's no funding to do it and you're not going to compensate the people that you're changing the alignment over to it, then I would have some concerns about that if they're not acquiring right away. Because some of these, it makes them undevelopable in a way. It's our uneconomical remainders are cut.
Very difficult. When you say not compensating, so do we, when we put a line on the map, we don't compensate property owners for lines on a map because it's a line on a map?
Well,
so I'm confused what you mean by compensating.
Normally when there's a line on a map, it's a grid type system, and it's done in a way that is planning for the future. That if we're going to have an RTO in this general location, it's normally split between properties. It normally doesn't bisect them at irregular angles. That's the one concern I have here is the irregular angles here where it doesn't really follow the property lines.
We have RTO atlases, and our RTO atlas doesn't have
my project right there.
All of it in straight lines.
Yeah, sure.
It's got those roads that are curved.
Yeah, usually around features though.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah. That's my gut reaction to it. I'd hate to own this piece of property right here. If I own this one or one of these other ones, I'd have problems.
They were actually southern leg of the line where this.
You want me to come ride to the rescue?
I'm not sure I do. I think your group does.
Again, I apologize for having my law partner had an urgent matter, but I feel like part of the issue with this was created by one of my clients. To be fair. But we did take a strong look at that where the red path is, and that's 101st Street.
I'm sorry.
And I think that the sentiment amongst everybody was that was a bad idea for multiple reasons. One is that the flyover that would be required over the rail line would be enormously expensive. On top of that, like the takeoff and landing, where it would have to go to get elevated would make it pretty physically obtrusive. And then the concept was that it would eventually connect out towards Patton way to the west. And part of the issue with where the red alignment was directly on the other side, the county approved some industrial buildings, so it'd be basically the road to nowhere.
And that segment was taken off the arterial atlas in 2016.
And it was taken off the arterial atlas, and so I think that this revised proposal to use the right-of-way that the county sort of preserved in the Curtain Creek area, this makes a lot more sense and sort of furthers that intent to make that
longer-term connection further to the west.
What's the alignment going west on the blue line and the yellow line?
It stops at Northeast 77th Avenue. 99th Street,
okay.
Yeah, it's about 94th, just to the east of this side.
But you know the area pretty well, too.
Yeah.
So, what? There's no there. The likelihood of being able to cross that railroad without something that's an overpass is
nil.
No.
How important is the arterial in this location anyway? Because here's what I see happening. Okay. We're going to redo this arterial atlas, and this property here will never get built because they're no longer economically feasible. So they're just never going to get built. So we're going to have this arterial atlas. It looks great on paper. Never going to happen. Why even have it on there?
And you know what's important to look at is the whole transportation system. So this is going to provide a lot of congestion relief for Northeast 119th.
Yeah.
So, and all the improvements that the county's made on Northeast 119th, so once that reaches the capacity, then this is going to come into play, and it's going to provide a lot of congestion relief. So we're here at the table. So this is for people that aren't here at the table. So the ones that are going to be here in the future to benefit from our choices made today aren't here at the table.
Yeah, they need to be. That's it.
I mean,
my only recommendation would be like the people who are on that yellow line need to have their input. If they're fine with it, I don't know, and then I'd support it, but I
we're going to have to acquire the right of way.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what it boils down to, is that, if this goes into the arterial atlas, there are at least two parcels that are going to have to get purchased by the county in order to build this. Otherwise, it's just never going to get built, because there's two parcels there that are
If
you take out enough of their land to build to build the arterial, there's just not enough left.
Yeah.
Well, one other thing I want to mention here is there is a thought, and I do believe this may be under process, of putting a spur in here too. So this becomes even wider.
Yeah.
It's just at a bad location where that corner is.
I guess what I'm saying is maybe the state, although they discourage it, if there was funding to build it, maybe they would allow the at-grade because of the low-volume railroad. We already have one here. We have one down here on 78, which are much higher volume roadways. So,
yeah, 119th, 106.
Yeah, all these have at-grades right now. It's like the characteristic of that railroad is a lot of at-grade. It's not like the Burlington Northern with very high traffic. So, I don't know. I don't know if we have enough information to really make a personally, I don't think I have a recommendation to make a recommendation either way. My only recommendation would be to reach out to the owners of the properties on here and make sure they are at the table. And then maybe fund it.
I've reached out to everybody in a huge area.
Are they okay with this?
Well, like I said, so it depends. If you live up here, you're okay with this down here.
Yeah.
If you live down here, you're not okay with this.
So they're okay with the plans that don't affect them.
Correct.
Yeah, sure.
Correct. So costs. Can I share some cost estimates? So the consultants looked at cost estimates. So the overpass, the cost of that, the total is around 21 million. Underpass would be a 19 million. Going straight across, alternative. Alternative
J.
J is 14 million. And alternative F.
Can't do anything here.
Is 15 million.
No, that's the reason not to do that one. So this makes.
Do those estimates include right-of-way acquisition?
So they're basically a 10% level estimate.
Okay.
So it doesn't include a lot.
Huh. So if you're looking at these two scenarios, I would say that the red line here, again, and the blue line here are very typical arterial locations in between property lines. They're what you'd expect to see, and the roads that you're going to need for circulation. The ones down here, basically where it's not straight, from here to here, okay, that section in here, I would almost put right-of-way acquisition in the estimate where you wouldn't have it on the other one, because the property literally will not develop with that line on it. They're just going to sit there forever. So you're basically creating a solution that's never going to get built unless the county forks out money. So I think that has to be factored into the equation. If I was able to. And then you know what? You buy the right of way, then you're good to go. That's a feasible location, and you eliminate the red line.
So, and they do, so they do say 18 parcels with 11 acquisitions required. So
they're
in here. They've talked about it.
Mm-hmm.
So it's all addressed. Everything's addressed. Mm-hmm. Right-of-way costs, environmental impacts.
So if this guy here comes in to develop his land, he's going to get paid by the county to develop that, or he's just going to have to give it to him?
Depends on if it goes on the CIP or not.
Right. It's not.
If it goes on the CIP, then he'll get compensated for the land? I don't think that's how it works.
No.
No. Just for the construction.
Just
that's
for
the problem. Yeah. Then usually just for the construction, not that land. Yeah. So I don't know. If I own this piece of property, or this one especially,
yeah.
I would say that this plan now basically would be almost a taking, because economically you can't even access that property off of there, and you don't have enough room to build a secondary road to develop your property, because you can't access off the arteria, you can't front it. So where do you put a side road in to actually even use that property? Or here, you can't even get to this. So you're creating an economic remainders that to make this an equitable plan, I'd say those two property owners at least would need to be, they're trying to acquire those to make it work. And then put a park there. It's not the other problem, too.
That's one way to look at it. The other way is if this is all one ownership, you can get to that from the south. This can, you can boundary line adjust all that and make it usable.
It
could be, but you're saying a total black negative, this is never going to happen, it's totally usable, it's a taking. But the other side of it is, yes, there's opportunity and it's still there. It could happen. Either way, it could happen.
Yeah.
So there's, it's a doomsday look, or it's a, hey, it can happen, it's possible.
It's possible.
It's possible.
And practical.
Yeah, it might not be practical, but, you know, it's...
Anything's
it's,
possible.
Anything's possible here in Clark County, we all know that.
I guess the way I look at it is the minute that yellow line gets drawn on the map, this... official. Maybe I just lost
100
bucks.
Yeah, so how's he getting compensated?
There's no way that he can get compensated unless there's...
Yeah.
He's stuck.
Well, so he's not stuck. So we see it all the time. So we get developers come in and say, look, this is not proportional, so this is not going to get built. Because my development is... It cannot afford to create a half street improvement for this development. If a development comes in, it likely won't occur because we have a road on a map.
So are you saying that it won't get built because it's disproportionate?
We could say we could require them to have dedicated right of way.
Yeah. They still need to access the sites.
Would it get built? So have we done that in the past? So if we have an R2 Atlas, 107. So some of the stuff that we've talked about in the past. I mean, everyone gets really squishy of, oh, well, am I required to build it? Well, what do you have to do? There's a line on a map, dedicate right of way at least. If they use the proportionality argument.
Yeah, if it's on the plan, then it gets down to if it's built, the credits and that sort of thing to be fair, right? That's where you get into that.
You can't issue credits, TIF credits,
and that's not. It's got to be on the plan.
Right.
Yeah. That's what I'm saying.
And you still don't get TIF credits for the right of way dedication. Usually.
Just the road bill.
And to be honest, I mean.
So that property would have to sue the county, basically.
Well, I don't know. I mean, you're not trying to go there, you're trying to find a solution that doesn't require something.
Understood.
Like that. And to be honest, they're going to need some kind of roadway down here anyway. So the difference between an arterial and a regular street is that you can't front it. I mean, basically, and access is restricted. So you actually have to build two streets. So not only are they building one here, but when they do their development, they're going to build another one here somehow. But they have to come off of this street at a right angle, try to find a way to serve this. There's not enough room between here and here.
It would have to be multiple parcels going together as a single development for it to be.
But then it's cornered to sell to the. So it's still stuck.
Gary, when planning goes through these, do you work with the PA's office to kind of get down in the weeds of that with the effects on property owners and doesn't happen.
It'd be worth talking to Chris Crawford before the work session. But this is the proposal I'm taking the Planning Commission this evening. So I'll let them know that you guys heard of it.
What do we want to do?
Yeah,
we
want to chime in. What's our position on
that? I'm going to abstain.
Did you guys both are involved in this project?
Yeah. No.
Well, if you abstain, then we're not going to be able
to. Well, to get that abstain,
would be a recommendation. I don't think we need a recommendation anyways. What I heard anyways is the big concern from the board is mostly just the impact of the alignment on the usability of the properties.
I think that's all we have to test now. That we have concerns about two parcels that are affected by this, and that this proposal may make them not economical to develop and significantly impact the value of the land. So, that's just an observation. We haven't been. There's a lot of stuff we don't know at this point. We've spent 20 minutes on it. There's always stuff we don't know. So I don't feel like comfortable saying, "Hey, we recommend it," but we don't recommend it. I would say all we have is concerns from what came out of our discussion about a few parcels on the curve especially that'll be significantly impacted by this new proposal.
And I just may make an observation though, just the flip side of it, having known where the grade separated railroad crossing would be, that doing a acquisition for the right-of-way on those other parcels would be a whole heck of a lot cheaper than doing a grade separated railroad crossing.
So that's it. If they're going to adopt this, maybe there has to be funding to back it up.
But that's the
to acquire those parcels.
But you said you've got 11 acquisitions in your report that went into the idea or whatever the estimates.
Well, that's probably just right-of-way. I don't think those are probably entire parcel acquisitions, though.
Yeah, there's some portions.
So who would have built the overpass? Because that's not going to be in private development. Did the county have funding to do that eventually?
No, it would be a county project.
It would be a county project. Yes. So the savings on that county project for that could go towards the acquisition on moving those funds from that to acquiring those other two parcels.
Could.
So maybe that's a solution. I don't know if I want to make a recommendation.
That's not.
That can be.
That's not out of the ordinary for.
Yeah.
When the county does major road projects, they're purchasing parcels because of the impact to that parcel, and then they end up with, those red and white auction signs on the side of the road that say surplus property auctions.
All right, so to try to boil down a motion then of what our concerns are, and we're not taking a position for or against, however, we have concerns about a few of the parcels on the yellow alignment that will be significantly impacted by this and might make development of those properties not feasible. And the other piece of it would be...
Or at least far more difficult.
What's that?
Or at least
more difficult. A lot more difficult. And then the other piece would be the at-grade crossing up here, that if the county had a budget for the at-grade crossing, some of those concerns to those properties may be alleviated by taking the funds dedicated to that overchange and making
I think the biggest point though right now is there are no funds dedicated to this to any of those projects
at all, period.
Right.
Because it's never made it onto the 6-year plan.
Or the 20-year capital facility plan. So there's no funds, period. So I can make that statement, but it doesn't help.
It doesn't, yeah.
But this would never get built by private development.
Right, but it's still unfunded. There's still no funds. There's no funds anywhere.
Yeah, it's just a line. It's a line right now.
It's a line on a map.
Yeah.
So.
Okay. Well, how about in the future, when this becomes more of a reality, becomes on a capital facilities plan, that they would consider right-of-way acquisition for the impacted properties, and it would be offset by not having to build that at-grade crossing. Because right now you're doing planning based on the cost of something that's not funded. And then you're acquiring property and you're pushing the county's, I mean, the way I would say it, if I own those properties, you're pushing the county's obligation to build that overpass. And now you're basically putting it on those properties and just kind of taking their land instead. So I don't know, horse in this game or a horse in this race, but if I was one of those property owners, I wouldn't be very happy with that going.
So is there a solution?
So you're one of those NIMBYs, because he said all the people along that line aren't happy anyway. So.
Well, on the red line, I'm trying to make them happy. Buy the property, then they're off the game. County's safe.
You guys, is there a solution then for as far as the timing? Because if you put that line on the map, then if that either of those guys would develop and it's not funded yet, so they're stuck not being able to develop until the funding is in place, or is there a mechanism that the county has to make a financial commitment to acquire that right away? Because otherwise it kind of timing wise it ties up the landowner's investment. They're maybe stuck for 20 years with, and they can't really sell it, they can't build it economically. Does that make sense what I'm asking?
That's kind of, I think that's the overall gist of the concern we have.
Is there some sort of solution or way to...
What we're hearing is no. There is.
I don't know that there is currently in any of that.
Mm-hmm. We don't have any current tools for that solution. The county doesn't buy right away.
Until there's a project.
So there's a project.
Funded.
Why even change this line until there's a project then? Maybe we're ahead of it.
Well,
someone's got to be putting their pocketbook where this, like...
Well, except if you don't, I mean, the way the arterial atlas works, if you know you need a road connection there, you got to have it on a map somewhere, otherwise you're not going to end up reserving even the right-of-way when development does happen. So, I mean, I get that piece of it. Roads are a little tougher than sewers, so I don't fully understand it. You know, we move our sewer lines around all the time, but it's just... As long as it goes downhill, it doesn't really matter. It doesn't have to connect from point A to point B necessarily. So
I don't think it changes the motion that much. I mean, I think basically we have concerns about the impact of those properties, and that sometime in the future, the cost of that, the county should consider offsetting the cost of that overpass that they're trying to avoid to compensate the right-of-way acquisition of those.
And I don't know if the cost even really plays into it. The concern is the impact to the property.
So maybe we leave that off then.
In the end, the impact of the property owner is the big one, because in the end, the county's going to have to buy those properties in order to build the road anyway. So the cost piece goes away at that point.
No, I think they're still making the private development build the road as they go.
It's not going to happen. So.
So we're basically just taking that stuff out of the comp plan, because that's never going to develop. It's not going to be economically feasible.
Well, but I like John's suggestion as well, though. If they look at the zoning in that area in conjunction with this, they might be able to, especially the two parcels up there on the north end that are residential zoned, if they can get those to a commercial or industrial zone, that would actually have more benefit to having the arterial there. That might help offset it a little bit, anyways. So. Anywho, all right.
So I guess our motion is just that we have concerns about the impact of properties. Now, it's just that simple, and then you guys can work out the details of those property owners.
Perfect. Thank you.
Is that a motion?
Is that a motion?
That's a motion.
Second.
Abstain.
I think it's been...
So it's just us three.
So I don't think we can pass it then.
No, we can't.
Well,
if they have abstentions, still count towards a quorum.
Okay.
So you still, as long as they're here, there'll be a yes vote, a no vote, and an abstain vote. And then that's what will be conveyed to the Planning Commission. I believe that's how it works in that situation.
Yes. What? A yes vote? Yes.
So one yes. How many yes?
Oh, three yeses and two abstentions.
Two abstentions.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
So you said this goes to hearing
tonight,
August 16th.
A work session tonight.
Adoption, or when's it actually get adopted? Well, so it's a Planning Commission hearing. They make recommendations to the County Council.
Right. Okay.
The County Council, it'll be sometime in late fall, early winter.
Do sparkle here.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks.
The wording's basically that the deed board had some concerns about the yellow alignment and how it affected some of the adjacent properties. It may make the development very difficult or infeasible.
I want to say the proposed yellow line?
The proposed yellow line.
Okay, the existing portion.
The proposed yellow line.
Yes, yep. The newly proposed portion of the yellow line. Okay. Now we're not on time anymore. We still have public comment.
I just have one brief one. On the site distance on the corner driveway location, I don't know, Greg and I had a meeting last week on it. I think you should revisit that again. Just based on kind of how the new interpretation is. They're taking the site distance all the way to the curb now, which is drastically restricting the driveway and 5 feet off the property line. Approach, but we can't leave the spacing because we're being overruled by site distance right now. So I have quite a few permits that I can't process or are held up in the county right now. Trying to get them through. I still think we all heard back from transportation today on the one that's been held up since July 11th, the stop signs that we need to submit for a stop sign. Weeks ago about putting the stop sign in, and I don't know when, you know, I submit a plan for the stop sign, how long that's going to take to get approved, so I can get my permit on a pre-sale that somebody's been hanging out for 3 or 4 weeks on. We don't know, it doesn't really make you look good because we've kind of already put these driveway drops on the engineering plan with the size of this piece that's approved by engineering already.
So there's this little corner.
The little corner is the black, which is on the lot.
Yeah.
And then the site distance right there is what we're being pulled all the way into. So,
well, it's in the right of way. It shouldn't matter after the sidewalk. Really, that little corner is the only real issue, isn't it?
So that's what's kind of being held up right now.
So Houston, with getting help out of traffic, I don't know, did you chat with Matt Griswold? He's a man.
Matt finally got back to APS this afternoon on the second or third try. I know we had talked about the minor deviation on all of them, but we were only able to get minor deviation on two of them.
The old ones.
And we're, well, and we're still waiting on the minor deviation for those two as well. So that's going over 2 weeks on that.
You already have an overlanked driveway on here where the car can pull up far enough to not have site distance being
issued. You're 26 foot on the driveway already, code's 18.
So you've kind of mitigated for the impact there already. You pull up further and you're out of there.
When you're in the, and when you're taking the site distance through the planter strip and the sidewalk all the way, it's kind of redundant because if you have a car parking there, that's a serious code violation. You're not going to have somebody parking there. You might have somebody traveling through there, but if they're traveling through their driveway, what's the difference, or the sidewalk, what's the difference between that and the street itself?
So, Ollie sent me an email last week saying it was only on the lot, not on the driveway. Is that changing? Great email.
On the what now?
So, the triangle only was on the lot, not on the driveway. So, it didn't go all the way to the curb.
Now, this is the only problem section that black part.
Yeah.
Because you can't park across the sidewalk anyway.
Right.
Yeah. Not legally. So okay, that's right. That should be an issue.
That's the new interpretation.
Yeah. But even this, it's a small amount. I don't know. You're going to be able to see over I don't know, it depends on the kind of car, but.
We agreed to leave that little triangle.
So who's
really?
Calling in? Who's calling in across the sidewalk?
That's the Urban Center says it's coming from public transportation. Apparently. Either
I think that's wrong
at the driveway.
So, and we had talked to Ollie with that too. So that's kind of, you know, I submitted. I've remodified that.
It's driveway. It's part of the driveway.
I remodified that driveway to 16 feet just so I can get it going. With the realization that I'll probably put a stop sign there, and by the time the stop sign's approved, then I can go 20 foot on the approach. But see, I don't know the process for when I put the stop sign in, but I'm guessing it's a 3, 4, 5, 6 week for signing and scraping, and I'm already 4 weeks out. So with the lien application, the house is approved.
We're definitely trying to get it to where it's a pathway forward. That was the purpose of incorporating the stop sign.
Yeah.
That virtually eliminates your sight triangle obstruction and all of that.
Yeah, right.
So that was the purpose in that. We did have one builder very recently come forward and say, mm-hmm. Hey, what about an extended driveway? If I go to the pains of notifying the property owner and I'm going to go out there and stamp the concrete and you know, make it a designated no parking, and also we're going to put it on the plat note, you know, just so it's recorded in awareness, we're going to allow for that. So I mean, but they're willing to.
Yeah.
So on that oversize, I could just paint it red or put it in the aggregate.
We're hoping, we'd prefer to see it stamped, because you know, painted, it's gone in a year, so.
Well, you go well, it like exposed to aggregate or something.
Yeah.
You know, they won't look aggregate.
I just, in this particular
example, I know that wasn't contemplated to that level when we first went into it. This is very recently came up. That's why we looked at that. So literally, I was waiting on Heath to get returned from vacation. He came back yesterday. I got with him. That's what the builder's offering to do. But it's fairly, you know, extensive to get there. But they would rather go that route. It's their choice.
Yeah,
than the stop sign. So they're actually willing to do that. But that was their proposal. They're going to make sure the driveway is long enough so that a parked vehicle can avoid it, and then actually stamp the concrete. Stencil it, you know, the no parking, and add that note on the plat that cannot be obstructed by parked vehicles. So,
and for the most part, the outer edge is probably a foot to 2 feet of the driveway isn't actually parking. It's usually for somebody to get out. So, and like that driveway, it's 26 feet long. We're talking a 4x4. So, for the most part, nobody's going to hang their car down there to walk it.
Yeah. It seems like a non-existent problem.
Believe me, we didn't want to get to this either. I mean, you know, the planning density, and I'm not trying to be at fault here, but I think that's kind of the big fundamental, you know, what's got us into this corner is the planning is just allowed for greater density. Well, now we're here, and now we're getting so many more where there is infringement on the site distance, and we just can't overlook that, you know. There is an incident there.
Stop signs are appropriate in those higher densities.
And that
that's
was
what we've decided.
That was the intent of bringing in the stop sign was...
But we have to have a clear path to get there. Well, and knowing that that's the case, it should be a simple process to get the stop
sign.
It's
a pretty big shock, too, when I've already done 7 and Mr. 5 in this plat since February, and then July comes in, now I'm talking corners. I've already done 5 corners in this plat since February. I got 4 more lined up in there, and all of a sudden I get one held up.
To me, that's kind of one of these big picture culture things with that, too. I mean, you can go, you know, I went back and I pulled the hearing from December the 12th of last year when we were all in public hearing, and the council was pretty clear that they didn't want stop signs to be the solution to this.
I didn't get that.
But I don't have an issue with stop signs. I'll let you know that there. We're on the east side, and they put stop signs in just about every.
Okay, but the point is regardless if. That was sort of I guess that was my understanding. Was
I'm not sure where that's coming from, Steve, because that's what was written into the code.
Stop sign was the solution to
that. That was the solution.
Yeah.
That was the solution.
To identify...
If you go back and listen to that hearing, you'll hear a couple of comments by the councilors that they're not real crazy about seeing a lot of stop signs. But that, regardless of that, the point is that we had multiple...
I hate to disrupt, but there's going to be a meeting after 5 o'clock. They need to start.
This is not the first project that we've had approvals by the county that proceeded on construction, then to have it turned around and new interpretation.
We might need to look at it to revise the code language to talk about the site distance, just so people are aware of it. So somebody doesn't buy it, if a non-developer buys a property and tries to put their driveway in and has to go through it. That's all I'm saying.
Maybe to close on that, Houston, so Jan Zala is coming in the next deed with code amendment updates. We want to start working on that. So.
I don't even know if it's a code issue. I think it's more of a application of the code that was there. And I don't know that, from what I've heard, I'm just kind of getting pieces, and this isn't the only builder that's mentioned it. We've had quite a few people mention it, but it's still a problem. And I think it's how the code is being implemented. So I think that's the next step, and making sure staff's on board with, if we need stop signs, do it quickly. We put them in. That's the balance of the competing interest. That was the intent. They don't. It really can't be discretionary.
We just met on that.
It has to happen.
We've got to get the county engineer's approval on it. But it should be a straight shot forward.
Get
the transportation traffic section.
Just in the meeting, I know I'm going forward with the stop sign. But just so I can get this along, can I get something? I already put the lot plan in and they rejected it. Just for that, to take that 4x4 chunk out. Can I get some movement on that for the county?
Who is that with? I mean, is that
from the center? Ray had said the public works with me. We'll get him on there for
Okay.
We're adjourned.